This is Market Life. Hello, and welcome to episode 21 of Market Life. I am your host, Adam Grimes. I am the CIO of Waverly Advisors. You can find my blog at www.adamhgrimes.com, and you can also follow me on Twitter at Adam H. Grimes. So this is a follow-up to my podcast last week in which I talked about market cycles, market regimes, and how markets move and shift between those cycles. If you have not listened to that, go back and do it sometime. Go and listen to this and then maybe go back and catch that. But what we're going to do today is to talk about how to actually execute, how to actually set up trades, how to actually trade around that concept of market cycles and the market moving through different cycles. You know, one of the criticisms that I've gotten about my work, whether it's my book or my blog post or the trading course, is that I don't tell people exactly how to execute. I don't hold your hand and say, here's where you should be pulling the trigger. And I'm going to explain in a little more detail today. I think that criticism is partially justified, but it's also partially wrong-headed, because the answer truly is, and this is an answer that when I was learning, I would have found very unsatisfying. In fact, it's an answer I got a lot. The answer is it doesn't matter. And I can remember being told that. You know, I would go to somebody and I would say, so I'm looking at this. Should I look to buy on this dip? Should I buy the breakout? Should I just buy in the pattern? Should I wait for the pattern to fail and then possibly recover and buy? And the answer that I got time and time again was, well, it doesn't really matter. And to me as a developing trader, that sort of gave me fits, because I thought, first of all, you know, do these people have secrets? Is there something that someone's not telling me? And I can say with assurance now, no, that's not the case. In some cases, you know, you even wonder, well, does this actually work? Is there a way to do this? And what this really is about identifying the potential, identifying the latent potential in the pattern, and then to a great extent, how you specifically execute around that does not matter. There are a few points, there are a few things that do matter, and we'll talk about that a little bit later in the podcast. So first of all, just a very, very quick review, 20-second review of the last week. What are our assumptions as we begin this? Well, whenever I look at the market, the first thing I assume is that most of what I see is garbage. Most of what I see is, or very well could be, random crap, and I can't tell the difference. I don't have any way to tell the difference. Now, knowing that, in a way, is very, very liberating, because I also know I'm going to be wrong a lot. And, you know, I think that's one of the things people talk about, the right mindset for trading, the right personality type for trading. And in reality, many different types of personalities can succeed at trading. But I think maybe the one thing you have to really be comfortable with in whatever style of trading is you have to be okay being wrong. And, you know, there are traders like me who will be very, very fast to say I'm wrong. You know, I can say I'm getting into this trade because of point one, point two, point three, point four, and because of this pattern and the way this related market, and I have a high confidence of getting into the trade. Okay, figure out my risk. Here's my position size, and I'm in the trade. And then if the market doesn't act as I'd hoped, pretty instantly, I'm wrong. I'm out. That's very easy. It's very easy for me. It's not a normal way for people to think. And, you know, reality is, I think most traders probably need to think a little bit more like that. But there are also traders that have a great deal of conviction in positions. And they'll do things like, you know, they're going to buy a market and it's declining, and they're going to buy more, and they're going to buy more, and they're going to buy more, and they're going to buy more. Or with stock traders, more often it's shorting into a bull market, and they keep shorting, and they keep shorting, they get shorter and shorter and shorter. And then the market makes a little move in their favor. And what do? They take off a bunch of the position, and they book some profits, they reduce some risks. And this is part of the skill, where many traders can be wrong for extended periods of time, but they still know, they have that squeal point. They know when it's time to run for the hills, when it's time to, you know, get out while the getting's good, as, you know, as the saying might go. So you do, however this works within your psychology, you got to be okay being wrong. And this is where the math for me is very liberating, because I know that the market is so random. I'm just going to be wrong. I can't be emotional about being wrong. Now, I'm a human, and more or less, and there definitely, you know, you will have strings of losers, and you also have strings of winners, and those do affect you psychologically. I would like to say they don't. You know, I'd like to say that I could trade with perfect Vulcan emotional detachment, pure logic, but the reality is we don't do that. Pretty much everything that happens, everything unusual, extreme like that happens, whether it's a string of winners or a string of losers, nothing is encouraging for me. You know, there are traders who will have a lot of winners and they'll get ecstatic and they'll think, wow, you know, I'm 8 winning trades in a row. I'm a genius. Let's size up. For me, I always get a little bit more fearful at that point. And I always think that, you know, as many of you know, I publish a research product and we have many clients who look at our stuff and who take our trading inputs in various ways. And there, we definitely go through cycles where it looks like I can do no wrong. Like every trade we call is exactly right. And I'm always around Waverly. I'm always kind of the voice of reason that says to everybody else in the firm, you know, we're not this good. Nobody's this good. We look like complete geniuses, but really, it's just the intersection of probability making us look really smart for a while. Now, the same is true. There will be extended periods of time when you have strings of losers, and you just have to tell yourself, you know, this is why you gotta understand randomness and strings and, you know, strings of winners and losers, and say, okay, you know, this is my 6th losing trade in a row. Here's another setup. What do you do? What do you do? You take the trade. You take the trade with proper risk. You manage the trade properly, because it's all just kind of random garbage kind of bashing you around. Another kind of interesting thing that, and this is something that I don't think I've really been able to articulate, because people, to me, what I'm about to say is a very profound observation. At least I think so, but hasn't really resonated with a lot of people. But you have winning trades and you have losing trades. And imagine that, I think maybe I even discussed this in one of the podcast episodes. Imagine that you're losing trades. Why do you lose? Well, there's a lot of reasons, right? But let's just separate those losing trades into two categories. One is, it was just random. The market was moving randomly and happened to show me the pattern that I thought I was looking for, and I took the trade, but there wasn't really an imbalance driving that, and it was just kind of a random setup, and I had a losing trade. It was nothing more than a coin flip because I was in a random situation. And then there's the other category of trades which were set up by some true market action. There was truly an imbalance in the market. I took the trade and the pattern didn't work out. So your losing trades are some conglomeration of those two categories of trades. There is no way to tease them out, but which maybe is why I say this and people are like, okay, you know, move on. It's just interesting philosophical stuff that isn't even interesting or useful. But if you could somehow separate out those truly random trades, I imagine what you would find is that the trades driven by actual market dynamics have a much higher win ratio. So you have your 50-50 trades that are just noise, and then you have your real trades, some of which are still going to be losers, of course. Nothing works all the time, but it's, and you just never know. There are all of these unknowns, and I think a lot about randomness. I think a lot about how probability and randomness intersects with my psychology, and the end result is more and more, it drives me back to the idea that to really keep me humble with how much I know about the market, which isn't really that much. So how do you execute? Well, in actual application, what I would do is I would wait for the market to make a big move. That is the market tipping its hand. Now, how do you quantify big move? There's a lot of ways. This is a case where moving averages and bands can be useful. And personally, I like Keltner channels. Bollinger Bands are probably more commonly used. There are some other ideas, but basically what these bands do, if you don't know, is you have a moving average, which is just the average of a period of prices. Maybe you're looking back over a week or a month or a year, whatever, it doesn't matter. And then you're going to put bands above and below that average. And as the market becomes more volatile, as the market bounces around more, then those bands will expand farther from the average above and below. As the market becomes quieter, the bands will tighten up closer. And this is a reasonable system because it reflects and respects the volatility in the market. But you have to realize we're still making some decisions. We're still imposing some things, some parameters on the market. How long is that moving average? How long is the period over which we're calculating volatility? How are we calculating volatility? How are we adding it or subtracting it to the average? Yeah, there's several ways to do that. In most cases, we multiply the volatility by some factor, whether it's 2 or 3 or whatever, and does that really make sense? And, you know, for instance, one of the common things that's out there, people talk about you use Bollinger's because at 2 or 3 standard deviations, and then they go back to the statistics textbook rules of thumbs for the percentages, not even going to say the numbers, for the percentages that should be within 2 to 3 standard deviations. And, well, the problem is, of course, the market is not at all normally distributed, and particularly what Bollinger's measures, standard deviation of price, not standard deviation of return. So the whole thing's kind of, I don't even have a word for it. The whole thing's a little bit odd, but we're still, you have to make some of those decisions. And in practice, I like Keltner's, set 2.25 average true ranges above and below a 20-period exponential moving average. This is not at all unique to me. A lot of people use this tool. I think perhaps Linda Rashke has probably done more than anybody else to popularize this. But it goes back to the 80s. Some of the very first charts were published, had tools like this. And actually, the Keltner channel idea goes back, I think, to the 50s. It was a little bit different, but a grain trader used a similar idea. So a lot of people have been doing this. There's no particular edge here, but if you have properly calibrated channels, they'll tend to contain across all different time frames, roughly the same percentage of prices. And the numbers I just quoted you contain roughly 85 to 90% of price action. So what this tells us is when the market pops outside the bands, the market's made an unusual move, and it's a move we should probably pay attention to. Now, if you've read my work, you know I'm a little suspicious about moving averages. And the reason is because when we actually do statistical tests, moving averages are complete garbage. And if you don't like that statement, I'll tell you something very quickly. Some of the research I've done is to look at when price engages a moving average and to look what happens after price touches the moving average, and does it look different? There's a lot of ways we can answer that question with different, but, you know, basically, does moving average provide support, or does going through, for in some ways you could do it. Let's say you have a market above a moving average, the market comes down and touches the moving average and bounces off of the moving average, or comes down and touches the moving average and you catch it before that bounce. Then you look at price action after that and you say, does that look somehow different, or is it just business as usual? It's touching the moving average actually an advantage? You could look at when it bounces. You could look at when it penetrates. You could just look at when it touches. A lot of different things. But, you know, people talk about these special moving averages. Oh, firms watch. What are firms? Firms watch the 50-period moving average. Institutions trade off the 200-period moving average. And you turn on the television, everybody, every technician is talking about price coming down to moving average. Or it's just garbage. Because you'll find the 200 looks like any other average. You know, if there are special averages, you can't have something that is both special and also invisible in the data, right? If the 200-period moving average does something, then we have to be able to see it in statistical tests. And at least in the work that I've done, I don't see it. However, there is still value to an average. And the idea is rather than being a precise line through the middle of your bars, it is this kind of fuzzy big area that's roughly the center. And it's kind of the emotional center, if you will, the comfort zone of the crowd. And just to have an idea of, is a market near its average price, or is it extended? And that's one of the questions bands can answer very well. Is the market extended from its center through the bands? So one of the things that I would look for, whatever bands you're going to use, just look for the market to make a significant move from the moving average. That's the first thing that I would look for. Now, again, as I said earlier, sometimes that's just going to happen. You know, if you look at random price data, you generate random price bars, you'll find sometimes there are large moves, just the way it works. But I think you're safe to make the assumption when you see a large move in the market that there is something driving that, and this should catch your attention to look for a potential trade. So once you have that large move, then the thought is, what do you do with that? Well, first of all, you have to decide what context you're going to trade in. Are you going to trade in a mean reverting context? Do you expect that move to be reversed, or do you expect it to continue? And does it matter? I have a note here as I'm looking at my notes. I think it does matter. I think, though, with proper trade management, you can make the argument that it might not matter so much. And we'll talk about that in a moment. You know, as you know, if you get in a market at any point, long or short, in most cases, you can make money on either side. If you had the benefit of perfect hindsight, it is possible with the fluctuations in the market to make money long or short at pretty much any point over most time frames. And you're going to have some places where you short and it just goes up, of course, but over a large sample of trades. And this is why your trade management style is also very, very important. But so let's divide this up. How do you know if you're going to trade the market in a momentum mode? Well, one thing simply is you look at what the market has done. We're going to talk about what we need to know is what the market's going to do in the future, but the only information we have is what the market has done in the past and is doing up to this point right now. And then we're looking at the future. So up in the recent past, is the market trending or is the market flat? Is the market chopping back and forth across a moving average? Is that moving average relatively flat? Now, again, I'm not a big fan of moving averages, but this is a way particularly that developing traders can use to read market action. Is the moving average sloping in one direction? Is price mostly on one side of the moving average? And do not get into this idea that the moving average is providing support. Don't get into the idea that you're going to buy at the moving average. Don't get into the idea that, oh, every time price has touched the 50-period moving average over the past 24 months, it has bounced with it. It's all garbage. It's just statistical noise. And if you generate random data and random averages and play with it, you're going to see that. And if you don't see that, then just please excuse my rant and just take it for what it is. Don't get suckered into that idea of you're going to be buying at moving averages. It's priced mostly on one side of a moving average. Don't get too much into the details. If the market is trending, then the trend is likely to continue. And there are some things, some variations of patterns. I've written a lot about these that can show that's going to end. But really, what we're looking for, if the market's been uptrending, makes another sharp move up, we can look to buy somewhere in the next consolidation, somewhere in the next pullback. That's your answer right there. If the market has been flat and all of a sudden makes a spike up, more often than not, that spike's going to be reversed. If the market's been trending up and makes a spike down against the trend, chances are that spike is going to be reversed. So there's your answer to trade with mean reversion or with momentum mode. Now, what happens after the spike also is important. And depending how you trade, you may have a winning or losing trade by this point, but it's also important to be able to read the ongoing development of the market. In that situation, market's been trending up, makes a spike down. And now I just told you that we would expect that spike to be reversed rather quickly, right? What if, however, the market makes a spike down and then keeps going down, 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 down? Now, if you bought that spike, you had to stop in, you have a losing trade, we don't care, we move on to the next trade. It's random, right? You don't care, you can't care. However, that tells us something about trend integrity, right? It does. What if you also had the situation where the market was trending up, has that spike down, you buy, and instead of getting a good recovery, you get a very slow recovery. Let's just make up numbers. $50 stock has a, which normally fluctuates, let's just say 5 points, has a 5 points, let's just say kind of a weekly range, and let's just say it has a single day drop of 8 points. Now, there's a big difference if that 8-point drop is recovered over the next 2 or 3 days and you're up 4 points and 5 points to new highs, or if the next day we're hanging out around within a point of that decline. And then maybe we go up a half point, maybe we're down half point, maybe we're up a point, maybe we're down a point and a half. So you're kind of bouncing around. If you can visualize that, you're kind of bouncing around near the bottom of that range. That's a very different situation. That's a market where mean reversion has failed. Now that tilts the scales in favor of another sell-off, because you have that strong momentum down, you have the consolidation, and then you have the edge to the market at least making another attempted sell-off, which might be absorbed into the higher time frame. The trend continues. Who knows? You have to read this ongoing story like that, but that's how you think about it. So if you have that kind of thinking about mean reversion just for a moment, one of the answers here is you trade smaller. And when I say trade smaller, your profit targets tend to be smaller. Your stops generally can tend to be closer to the market. And I would also encourage you, maybe this is wrong, but one thing that's worked for me is to trade these on smaller size. Because I know if there's ever a situation where I buy a market and I think I'm risking X, and then I come in tomorrow and it's gapped 4X beyond my stop, and I have a 4 or 5X loss, and that's going to happen, by the way. If you think every one of you're never going to have a larger than 1R loss, you're wrong. You are. You absolutely are. And you're going to have some stunning losses sometimes. But where that's usually going to happen is when you're buying a trend reversal, or when you're trading mean reversion, when you fade a spike at the end of a trend and then it just gaps and goes the next day. And you have some trade management issues around that, but it'll happen. To mitigate that, I also trade smaller risk on those, and it reduces the overall volatility, also reduces the overall profitability. The optimal decision mathematically is probably not to trade smaller and just to accept those larger losses, because you are going to have some large wins. You'll definitely have, when I think back over the really standout good swing trades in my career, a lot of them were buying overextended markets or shorting overextended markets, and then sometimes they had huge profits within the space. I'm going to say days, but you know, depending how you trade, could be 5-minute bars. You have very, very quick reversals there. So you have some offsetting profits too. Now, how do you actually execute? Well, so going back to the criticisms that I hear of my work, you know, people talk, there's several books. I'm not going to mention authors. Most of you listening know who I'm talking about, who publish these books that have page after page after page of charts with numbered bars telling you how to think, what to do on each bar. And, you know, I did a little bit of that in my book, and I debated doing more, and I decided not to do it because to some extent it's disingenuous. Anybody, I can train somebody for 2 or 3 days and they can generate a book that looks like it was done by a professional trader. It's so easy to create those stories, if you will, in retrospect. And I'm not saying that all of those books are done like that. Some of them may have been done in real time, but I think one of the things the trading community is starting to see, and raise your hand if this is true, is that that type of careful bar-by-bar instruction, while it's interesting, while it's fascinating, while it's seductive, while it seems to be educational, does not carry through to application quite so easily. You can look at hundreds of charts and read somebody's reasoning for each price bar, be able to replicate that reasoning, but then when you're faced with that hard right edge of the chart and you're trading in real time and you don't know what's going to happen on the next bar, it's a very, very different situation. So that's, you know, maybe there's value there in helping you to read market structure, but I don't really think it's that difficult to do that. I don't think you need to look at hundreds of charts. I think what is very helpful for me is this mindset of, first of all, understanding the potential in the trade. And now I have told you how to do that concretely. I've given you, and you can adapt this to any time frame, this is what I, and if you're intraday trading, there's some other tendencies around the higher, the low of the day, previous day's higher, low, all-time highs and lows. So there are different things that may play an addition, may just give you an additional edge, but this core idea of being able to look at a market and to parse it into mean reverting momentum. And when I say that, we're looking at the probability of the near future. That's the skill. That's what you need to be able to do. And it is a little bit subjective. It is a little bit soft. It is definitely inductive. There may be a little bit of intuition involved. Though the reality is you can quantify a lot of this more than you think. If you have done that, I don't care how you execute. It really doesn't matter. And I said that as a criticism. If you listen to the previous podcast, I said that, you know, there were people who said, all you got to do is create a trend following and a mean reverting system and then just know when to trade them. And I said, well, it's kind of silly because it's trivial to create those systems. If you're in a trending market, you simply buy or short, you don't care. In a mean reverting market, you fade, you don't care. It's not difficult to do. Trivial is the word. It is absolutely trivial. However, what I've just given you is the way, at least for short-term traders and for swing traders, to be able to separate those environments and to say, do I apply my going with or my going against system? My going with entry points, my going against entry points. And then there are some concrete ways you can do it. You know, like if the market has made a move up and is now consolidating and you're looking to buy for another move up, how are we going to actually execute that? Well, some ideas, just buy the breakout of the previous bar's high. Why not? Buy a test on a lower time frame of some kind of support. Buy a test on your trading time frame, a failure test around a previous low. Buy some dip that is quickly recovered. Buy the first close that closes above the previous bar's high. Executing on the previous close is something that probably more swing traders should do or could think about doing. In most cases, it's possible in the open to get some price near the previous close. So it really doesn't matter. And a lot of this is personal style. You do need to be consistent. You need to work within the volatility of the market. We'll talk about that in a little bit more. If you're trading mean reversion, market makes a quick spike up. You expect it to reverse. How do you execute? Well, we kind of don't care. Do some kind of lower time frame breakdown. Just short the bar when it closes. Put a stop somewhere. Wait for a day or two consolidation. Short the breakdown below that previous low. It doesn't matter once you've identified the potential. Identifying the potential is really where the edge is, and that's where the skill is, and that's where the experience is. And doing this all within the wrapper and the mindset of you're going to be wrong a lot because this is all pretty random and pretty fuzzy anyway. That's psychologically a big part of the answer. So what does matter? Well, it's having that context. Having that context does matter. Having the discipline, the psychological focus to execute correctly matters. Having correct risk. And that correct risk has two pieces. It's correct risk as a size of the market move. You know, there's like this kind of, a lot of people talk about trading with very, very, very tiny stops. And I've heard a lot of people talk about that. Maybe it works for some people. I've never seen it. I've never seen anybody be successful with very, very tight stops over any significant number of trades. You can always point to one trade. Well, gosh, you know, I shorted there. I put my stop one tick below the Fibonacci level. Crap, whatever. It's really hard for me not to swear in these podcasts sometimes. But I manage, right? I think you just have to trade with some type of mindset that respects the reality and the volatility of the market. So you have to use reasonable and correct stops. The other part of your correct risk is that you're risking the correct percentage of your bankroll, of your trading capital. So you can't be going into trades risking 20% of your account. You're wrong two or three times and you're out of business. It also doesn't make sense if you are a working trader to trade risking maybe 0.1%. There's some happy zone in there that, depending on the characteristics of your trading style and your time frame and your market, makes sense for you. And for most traders, it is far, far less than 5%, usually somewhere in the neighborhood of 1-3%. But again, that varies, and it certainly depends on a number of factors. Probably the most important thing is how you manage trades. Trade management decisions matter much more than entry. Where are you putting your profits? Where are you putting back? You know, it's all kind of ties together. Where are you putting that initial stop? What are you going to do once you're in the trade? And are you going to do it with the correct focus? So I hope that answers some of those questions. I've been getting some few questions about where you actually pull the trigger. And I wanted to give you some thoughts about that and why it doesn't matter. But just saying it doesn't matter, do whatever you want, is not the best answer. So I hope I've given you a bit of structure to go around that. If you have not signed up for my mailing list, please go to my blog, adamhgrimes.com. In the upper right-hand corner, there's a place to put your email address. I send a couple emails a month. I do not spam. I do not sell your email. I won't do anything like that. But I just like to have a mailing list to keep in touch with people. So please do sign up for that. And if you have a few moments, a review on iTunes would be very, very much appreciated. So I certainly thank you for your time. And I will see you back next week for the next episode. Thank you. It's never hard to turn away from everything that needs done today. But I'll take the time.